Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. Our special evening edition this Thanksgiving week begins with a pair of made-for-TV movies coming later this week. Brigham Young University Television offers Instrument of War Thanksgiving Night, inspired by the courage of a World War II prison camper. The trio of movie makers behind this film, producer Russ Kendall, writer Mike Whitaker, and director Adam Thomas Anderegg, join me next in Internet Radio Exclusive Live from Utah. From there, a rare live radio encounter with mega-popular author David Baldacci. His best-selling novel, The Christmas Train, becomes the latest Hallmark Hall of Fame presentation Saturday night. Damon Maroney, Kimberly Williams-Paisley, and Danny Glover are three key players. And executive producer Karen Spiegel comes by with Baldacci next half hour. And we'll round things out with Emmy-nominated composer Hallie Kotary, who's now connected with Hulu's new time-traveling drama, Future Man. Also ahead, CBS off Dish, Charlie Rose off both CBS and PBS, AT&T versus DOJ, and our classic trivia question this week. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, live from New York on Blog Talk Radio and distributed through the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. This just in, Thanksgiving week continues, and tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, proud development sponsor of the 2017 New York Television Festival, and a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in the program. Welcome to the evening on the East Coast, mid-afternoon on the West Coast, and for everywhere else, whatever time zone you're in, it's a pleasure for you to be with us on the program All About Television. 54 degrees at the top of the hour here in New York. We have a great 90 minutes in store for you, super guests from all over the place, and we invite you to be part of the program. It's so simple. Pick up the phone, raise your voice, use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. That number's good anyway. You're catching us across the country or around the world here on Blog Talk Radio. Another way you get involved is our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You will find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. So use the phone or the room. We're waiting to hear from you. And while the program is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk screen, and other people can be live with you. Our trio from Instrument of War on BYU TV will join us live from Provo, Utah, after these news notes. A pair of aftermaths is front and center with CBS this evening. First, dealing with the aftermath of firing CBS This Morning co-anchor person and correspondent Charlie Rose. He was shown the door by CBS this afternoon, almost 24 hours following revelations of sexual harassment by a group of 9 former PBS talk show associates in the Washington Post. PBS has responded to the situation by also dropping Rose's long-running late-night interview hour and firing primetime highlight half hour the week. In a statement released last night, Rose acknowledged the situation, and I quote, "I deeply apologize for my inappropriate behavior. I am greatly embarrassed. I have behaved insensitively at times, and I accept responsibility for that," unquote, Rose noted. In emailing staff about Rose's dismissal, CBS Network President David Rose said, and I quote, "There is absolutely nothing more important in this or any organization than ensuring a safe professional workplace." Aftermath number two for CBS, Dish customers waking up this morning to find the network and CBS affiliates off their service. The blackout started around 2 a.m. Eastern Time and continues at this hour. CBS Sports Network, Pop TV, and Smithsonian Channel also are dark. Dish and CBS failed to reach a new carriage deal yesterday, although Dish representatives claim they were willing to extend the discussion past midnight to strike a deal. Both companies blame each other for the blackout, which has impacted about 13 million Dish satellite customers across the country. AT&T says it will get a day in court with the Justice Department if that's what it takes to acquire Time Warner. The DOJ announced an antitrust lawsuit against AT&T yesterday, claiming a combo AT&T-Time Warner merger will stifle competition distributed services from TNT to DirecTV Now. We'll keep you posted on how things go. And we've got some quickies. NBC will bring back The Good Place for a third season, despite so-so ratings so far this one. Black Lightning, the CW's next superhero hour, will debut January 16th. And that's also the debut night of The Pains, Tyler Perry's next comedy effort for the Oprah Winfrey Network. And that is news notes for today. For the second straight year, BYU-TV, which is still the only college university to have its own national network with about 65, 70 million subscribers across the country, will be doing a made-for-TV movie on Thanksgiving night. Last year, it was called Winter Thaw. This year, it is Instrument of War, which is based on the true story of a World War II prisoner of war who uses an instrument to stay alive and keep his sanity. The program will air at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific Time on BYU-TV. Joining us live from Provo, Utah, is the producer of both this movie and last year's film, Winter Thaw. He's back with us again for the second year, Russ Kendall. Russ, great to have you back.
Thanks, Simon. Good to be with you.
And joining us as well, also from Provo, Utah, the writer of Instrument of War, Mike Whitaker, and the director, Adam Thomas Andrade. Both of you gentlemen, welcome in.
Thank you, Simon. It's great to be back.
Thank you, Simon.
Well, starting with you, what had BYU make this movie? What inspired the story?
BYU was looking to do another holiday film, you know, one that, you know, wasn't your traditional holiday fare, you know, wasn't a Hallmark-type movie, and so we presented them with a few different ideas, and Instrument of War being one of them. The story came about as we were looking for unique stories. Came across the number of accounts of POWs in German prison camps in World War II that were telling this tale of a fellow POW that had made a violin and had played this violin at Christmas time, and you know, in really depressing, dark time for them, this music that Claire Klein, this POW, played on this violin really brought a lot of peace, brought beauty into a really dark time and situation for them. And this account made it into a number of journals and letters back home. And further searching came across the account that Claire himself had given later on in his life, a short account of making a violin in a camp. And when, you know, read that, it was just like one of those moments where, you know, the hair on the arm stands up and you're just like, this is it. You know, we could really create something powerful out of this. And pitched it to the guys, and they said, yeah, we love it. And took it to BYU, and they saw the power in the story and got fully behind it.
And that brings you into the picture, Mike Whitaker. How did you get involved with this project? And when you got the assignment, what immediately sprung to life about how to make this work?
Well, it was an easy pitch for us. It was the kind of story that a screenwriter just, you know, loves to get. And I'm a huge World War II buff. My father had been a B-24 bomber pilot in World War II. And so when I heard about the story of a B-24 bomber pilot who was shot down and what he did in this prison camp, I was all in from the beginning, you know. And it really was just a matter of doing as much research as I could, finding out what we knew about the story, talking to this pilot's children and getting their perspective on it, and then just diving in and, you know, essentially putting pen to paper.
Mm-hmm. Adam, when I first heard about this movie, what immediately came to mind was a film that CBS did decades ago called Playing for Time. It was written by Arthur Miller, who won the Emmy Award for it. It was a very moving film. Vanessa Redgrave led the cast. It was about a group of women who were also prisoners of war in World War II, and they somehow were able to be part of a Nazi orchestra, an orchestra run by the Nazis, that would basically be their avenue to staying alive. I don't know if you saw Playing for Time. It was I think one of the best pieces of movie making at that time in television. This was back like late 70s, 80s. But I was curious, Adam, that when you got the assignment to do this film, what did you think of in terms of how you treated the story?
Well, Playing for Time was a great movie, 1980. I actually hadn't thought about that until you said this, Simon, so that's kind of fun. I'll have to go back and watch it again. When we approach a film, a story, we always try and find something that has some human value to it so that it's worth the time that it takes us to make the movie, and it's worth the time that the audience has to watch it. So this was one of those stories that passed muster, and we just said, this is going to be an amazing film. And, you know, honestly, it didn't get any more complicated than that for me.
Mm-hmm. Russ, is Chris Klein Claire Klein still alive, or were you able to contact his family to try to get some, or to flesh out some details about what he went through before you went into production?
Right. Yeah, after we pitched the story to BYU Broadcasting and got their support, it was then, okay, we need to, secure the rights to the story and begin researching it. And so we tracked down the son of Claire Klein. Claire passed away in 2010, but we got in touch with Roger Klein, and Roger, it was an interesting call to, out of the blue, call someone up and say, you don't know me, but I'd like to make a movie about your dad. And, Roger, checked out our work, checked out the work that BYU Television does, and he was in. We established a great relationship with him, both Adam, Matt, myself, and Roger. And I know Matt spent quite a bit of time with him, and he can speak to that, fleshing out the story. Like many World War II veterans, Claire came home and just went on with life. He didn't share a lot about his experiences of, he was shot down, ended up, parachuting out of a hit airplane and, in 14 months in a prison camp and, just kind of kept all those feelings and that experience to himself until later in life. And it was interesting to talk with Roger as he started talking to his sisters and they started talking about their mom and dad and going through old letters and things. It was a wonderful experience for them to kind of reconnect and learn things about their parents as they were trying to help us flesh out this story. It was a great experience in learning and connection for them and their folks. Maybe Matt can probably share more about the, fleshing out the story part.
Yeah, when Roger sent me a copy of his mother's diary, a daily diary that she kept every day while her husband was a prisoner of war, and then some letters that, a few letters that he was able to send out and letters that she'd sent to him, that's where things just really opened up. And that's where we actually started creating, his wife, Annie. She became a much more important element and character in the story than we had initially, thought she would be. But reading her daily, concerns and pining for her husband and was he alive and how is he doing? If you see the film, almost every word that her character speaks in it comes straight from her diary. Just a really beautiful experience to take that and just put it there in the script and eventually onto the film.
That's pretty remarkable.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
I just think that's pretty remarkable. That we have her exact words, and that those are the words that make it into the movie. I think that's really rare.
Instrument of War is the second annual Thanksgiving Night original film on BYU Television. It happens at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific, 6 o'clock in the Mountain Zone where BYU TV is based. And we've got the trio of people behind making this film, producer Russ Kendall, writer Mike Wicker, and director Adam Thomas Egerig. They're all joining us live from Provo, Utah this half hour on Tomorrow We Televise. Simon Appleband with you live on this Tuesday night or Tuesday afternoon, depending on where you are across the country, here in New York on Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to those of you checking us out on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name, our good friend Rick Webb from Philadelphia, already in the room. We have one more 90-minute episode coming your way, our third of three Thanksgiving Week episodes this week. Kicking it off at our regular time, 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific, we'll have popular radio and podcast host George Bettinger with us. I was on his program a week or so ago. He'll be on my show, Return the Favor. We'll talk about his thoughts of where TV is at and where it's going, and also his thoughts about TV Thanksgiving time, what he likes and what he'd like to see a little different. That's going to be in our first half hour. And then we're going to focus on two projects that are coming away next week. The first comes next Monday night on Freeform. It's a new movie called Angry Angel. It's the first Christmas movie under the Freeform title. It stars a wonderful actress. Many of you remember her from work on Disney Channel shows, Brenda Song. We've got executive producer Richard Schwartz on the program. And finally, as a very special pre-Thanksgiving treat, we have not one, but two of the co-stars of the brand new Amazon series from the Paladinos of Gilmore Girls fame. That's the marvelous Mrs. Maisel. We've got the actor who plays Mrs. Maisel's husband and the one that plays her mother. We're talking about Michael Zegan and Maren Hinkle. They'll both be with us live. That's coming up tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, 9-minute pre-Thanksgiving Day edition of Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Be with us and tell your friends. It's going to be quite special. Adam, what was your thoughts about making the film? What was going through your mind about how you wanted to showcase this very unique tale with a musical beat to it?
I appreciate you asking that question. It's an interesting kind of prison camp. These Stalagmites were, you know, not the concentration camps. And so there was an opportunity to show a different kind of a story. Stalagmites were generally holding camps. They weren't hard labor camps. There were some that were different than that. But this Stalagmite one, where Claire Klein was held, was in Barth, Germany, and it was essentially an officer's camp. Those officers were protected under the Geneva Convention, and the Germans kept those rules in this camp. And so there was a completely different tone in this story than you'd see in a typical World War II prison camp kind of a story. So that was the first jumping off point that I thought was interesting. And we were able to film the film in Lithuania and create a camp set that was just really amazing to work in. We used a location that had some existing buildings, some masonry buildings that were just perfect for this kind of a thing. It looked like buildings that had been built for something else, and the Germans had kind of taken them over. And then we were able to build several buildings that were just plywood barracks, similar to what you've seen in some of the other camps, and then augmented the size and the shape of the camp with computer-generated images, you know, set extensions. And I got to tell you, when we walked out there in that camp setting, in the middle of, you know, cold Lithuania spring, it was March and April, and looked up at that Nazi flag and all of these guys dressed in their World War II clothes. I was transported there, and you get that in the film. I mean, it's not just normal set or production design, but you get this sense that you're in a different kind of time and place than maybe you've seen or expect to see.
Russ, who did you get to play Klein?
Jack Ashton, great actor, a great British actor, mostly known for Call the Midwife. He played Claire Klein and did a fabulous job. He's a great actor, and had a real pleasure working with him.
Mm-hmm. Mike, what were the key points about what Klein went through that you wanted to bring out the most to the audience when they watched this show Thursday night?
Yeah, well, and harkening back to something that Adam said is that, you know, these people weren't being tortured to death, but a very real problem for them was psychological survival. You know, some of them, when they got in and would hear that, hey, you got to keep your sanity, you know, you got to keep from being bored, they would kind of scoff at that and say, hey, you know, I welcome some boredom. But the truth was is that these men would eventually, some of them would go, you know, kind of go what they called wire happy or wire crazy and try and jump over the fence and you know, and then get killed trying to escape. And so to find something that could keep them, help them keep their sanity was very important. And specifically with Claire Klein, it was this connection between music and a violin and his wife, Annie, who was at home, and for whom he had played before he left, you know. And so when he decided to build this violin, it represented, yes, an attempt to have something to do to try and keep his wits about him, but it really represented his love for his wife, you know. So when we see these scenes of him, you know, carefully crafting this beautiful instrument out of a piece of glass, you know, that he had to work with, it's really about him saying, I love my wife, and I'm going to make it home to her.
Alan, when you're dealing with a subject and a character like this, where a lot of the situation is psychological inside this camp, how do you showcase it on screen? Do you look to other movies that have tackled the subject for inspiration? For example, Billy Wilder with Stalag 13, that great performance by William Holden, or while it's on a prison camp situation, I think it's pretty apropos what John Frankenheimer did in the great classic of his, The Venturian Candidate.
Yeah. You know, it depends on what the scene is. My approach usually is to try not to go back and watch other directors and actors' work, even if it's wonderful and great, because it's, you know, it's already influenced me on some level. But it is to try and connect with the actor that is portraying the actor or actors that's portraying the scene, and to try and find something in them, in their experience, that, you know, that allows them to bring it to life in a way that is fresh and unexpected and, you know, completely real. And it's a challenge because, you know, you've got a camera usually about, you know, on this film, we're in a lot of dark spaces, and Wesley Johnson, the DP, who, by the way, is fantastic, and he's one to watch. You're, you know, with an open lens, an open stop, and sometimes the camera is as little as a foot or two away from the actor, and there's only about an inch of depth of field. Now, that's a lot of technical talk, but basically what it means is there are a lot of restrictions for that actor. They can hardly move, and so it's really important to just let all of that disappear and find a way to, you know, become that person and go into that space. And so I just focus on that. There was one time with Jack that I just said, you know, he was doing the scene, a particular scene, in a way that I didn't really feel it. And I just went up and I whispered in his ear and I said, "What's the time that you were most betrayed in your life?" And he kind of looked up at me and he just nodded. And honestly, that's all it was. And then he, you know, as a great actor, and all the other cast, really a fantastic cast that I'm really proud of, they were able to bring it, you know, and that's, I guess that's the way you do it. You depend on your actors.
Mm-hmm. Russ, one of the most unique aspects of the film is the music. And here is where your film has a big coup, because the 2-time Oscar winner for films A River Runs Through It and Crash, Mark Isham, is the composer. And some of you may remember that over the last 3 seasons, he did the music for American Crime, the brilliant John Ridley series on ABC, which I thought should have won more Emmy nominations and more awards than it picked up. And I mentioned Mark in particular because in American Crime, he uses the violin a lot. His theme, for example, was a very nice violin solo that really echoes at the beginning of, or near the beginning of each episode, or close to many episodes. What was it like working with Mark, and how did he take the idea of using the violin, which is so important in this film, and capturing the mood of what this prisoner was going through in his music?
Yeah, Mark is a treasure. You know, what he is able to do is really make music a character in the film, and that was paramount in this story, where the melodies and the themes that are played really play a role. And one of the things we had to do was work with Mark prior to filming and come up with the theme that Claire plays for his wife before he ships off to war. And so that piece of music had to be written before camera started rolling. And Mark wrote that in about a week and a half. As films go, it's very tight schedules, and Mark came on board, and we're like, awesome, we need a theme in a week and a half. We start shooting, and like a consummate professional, he got to work and, you know, sent over a beautiful, simple, yet haunting melody that it was just perfect. You know, he had the script to go off of, we had discussions, and, you know, he nailed it. You know, we knew this needed to have kind of, at least that theme needed to have somewhat of an Americana folk type of feel to it. Claire was not a professional or classically trained violinist. He was more a, you know, amateur or hobbyist. And so it had to be something, you know, believable for the character. And so Mark composed that, sent over tracks with Click that we could play on set and have have Jack, you know, play along with the best he could. We also had violin hand doubles on set. You know, then after we finished, you know, Mark, you know, got the rough cut. And tell you what, there were very few cues we had to go back and forth on. And when we did, you know, through discussion, I mean, everything just became even better, more elevated. He's, just brings an incredible touch to the story. And one personal note for him, you know, when he read the screenplay, because of the theme of music, it resonated greatly. But also, his father was a violinist. And so, you know, you mentioned the work he does where the violin is quite prominent. You know, I'm sure that has something to do with, you know, his father, you know, playing violin, him, you know, bringing that to bear in his scores.
Russ, before we wrap, you had a great success with Winter Fall last year. The New York Times, which rarely reviews BYU TV programming, did so in this case, thought it was one of the best, if not the best, serious Christmas movie of the season. Hopefully
right.
They will weigh in a review for this one, this coming Thanksgiving night. But BYU has made a commitment to do more original programming next year. They're working on some things to merge some different elements. Are all three of you going to reunite on a project for BYU or someplace else down the road?
Yes, certainly. We're in development on a couple projects with them, some non-scripted content, and potentially some other feature films coming up. And so we're excited about our relationship and partnership with them, which has lasted a number of years. We've worked with them closely. They're committed to creating content that, you know, sees the good in the world. And that's, you know, a kaleidoscope. That's what we do. You know, in the stories we tell, we want them to be uplifting and show, you know, the positive things out there and shed a light. So...
the film is Instrument of War. It's the second consecutive Thanksgiving night movie for BYU TV. It was available on cable throughout the United States, about 65, 70 million subscribers all over the country, and it's still the only college university with its own national television network. Check your local to where BYU TV is in your area on cable, and remember, the film plays in different time zones at different times. It's 8 p.m. Eastern, it's 5 p.m. West Coast, et cetera, between 6 p.m. in BYU's area of Utah. For more details about the program and on BYU TV overall online, here's where you go, BYUTV.org. That's BYUTV.org. BYU standing, of course, for Brigham Young University. Russ Kendall, producer, Mike Whitaker, writer, Adam Thomas, and Rick, director, thank you all very much for joining us this Tuesday night. Happy Thanksgiving to all three of you and your family and colleagues, and let's hope for a wonderful, terrific film coming to viewers across the country this Thursday night.
Thank you. Our pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Simon.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Happy Thanksgiving to all three of you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Russ Kendall, Mike Whitaker, and Adam Thomas Andreg all joining us live from Provo, Utah this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. More of the program coming up, including a live interview with popular author David Baldacci on his new adaptation, The Christmas Train, for the Hallmark Hall of Fame. That's coming up next half hour. But first, we have some words from the fine people at Audible.com. You know, this is the holiday season. You want to give something very special, very unique for someone you know, someone you love? I got the idea just for you. Give them two gifts in one, the gift of reading and the gift of listening. And you can do both by offering a free trial subscription with Audible.com. It's a one-month trial with one free audiobook of their choice. And that book might be the new one from Tyler Perry. We told you his new series, The Pains, is coming up in January on the Oprah Winfrey Network. He's got the also big deal with Viacom that will kick in for various Viacom networks in 2019. But right now, you can offer a wonderful gift from some of you know this Thanksgiving or Christmas season or Hanukkah season two. It's Tyler Perry's new book, in audio form, Higher is Waiting. And you can get that with a trial subscription for you or someone you know with Audible.com. Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information with over 180,000 titles to choose from. You can listen to them on any device, including wherever you are hearing us on right now at Blog Talk Radio or iHeartRadio. And if you sign up at audibletrial.com/televised, you get one free audiobook, 1 month trial of service, and great customer service from the fine folks at Audible's parent, Amazon.com. So this holiday season, do something different. Do something very special for yourself or someone you love. Give two gifts in one, the gift of listening and the gift of reading. And most importantly, give them a way to transform the way you hear the world with Audible.com. Once again, for a free trial and free book, it's audibletrial.com/televised. When we come back, we're going live to Fairfax, Virginia, and Florida. And we're going to hear from the people behind the brand-new Hallmark Hall of Fame presentation, The Christmas Train, coming live on Hallmark Channel Saturday night. Hollywood author David Baldacci and executive producer Karen Spiegel join me shortly after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You are connected to the best internet radio on the planet. It's www.blogtalkradio.com for the 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. And listening to us on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network, available 24/7 at iHeartRadio.com. On Blog Talk Radio, it's your home for the Hope for Lunch Bunch. Check out tomorrow, noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific, exclusively on Blog Talk Radio. And remember, best beats are available 24/7 at YouTube.com. Welcome back to the second half hour of our 90-minute evening edition of Tomorrow We Tell Live. Simon Appleman with you live from New York. Thank you for joining us 3 hours later than normal for this special 90-minute edition on pre-Thanksgiving Day Tuesday of 2017. Simon Appleman with you live from New York. More great guests coming away in the hour ahead. And we invite you to be part of the program. It's so simple. Just raise the voice, pick up that phone, and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, Simon Apple 04 by name. No television series, no television specials, no one television venture has had more awards, more prestige, and a longer lifespan than the Hallmark Hall of Fame. It started as a series of live and tape theater presentations in the 50s and 60s. In the 70s and 80s, it became a great home for all sorts of made-for-TV movies. And now, the Hallmark Hall of Fame is exclusive on the Hallmark Channel. It's been that way for about a year. And for this Christmas season, they have a very special new presentation that premieres this coming Saturday night. It's called The Christmas Train. And it is based on one of the best-selling novels by one of the most popular authors in the universe. Joining us live for a rare live radio interview from Fairfax, Virginia, is that author, David Baldacci. David, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And joining us as well from Florida, Palm Beach Way, is the executive producer of the adaptation of The Christmas Train, Karen Spiegel. Karen, happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for having us.
David, what made you decide at long last this novel becomes a movie?
Well, I wrote it a long time ago. I actually took the two trains across the United States while I was working on another book and had no idea that I was going to be writing a book about the Christmas train, but I had a great time on the train and met a lot of people and had a lot of notes. By the time I got to California, I flew back and started writing it, and I decided to set it during Christmas. And what better partner than Hallmark to turn this into a film? And it's a beautiful holiday film, and that's what they specialize in, and they were wonderful to work with, and the film really is beautiful and is really faithful to the book, and for an author, that is really important, and I think they just knocked it out of the park.
Is this the first time that any of your work, any of your novels have been adapted for made-for-movie length?
I've had two feature films done and a television series. This really is the first time I've had a movie done for television, and Hallmark was a great partner to work with. Obviously, I've had kids, and my kids are both grown, but we watched a lot of Hallmark movies over the years, and I really felt like they were the right place, the right venue to bring this book to life. I'm a thriller writer, so I'm probably one of the very few thriller writers that ever had a film on the Hallmark Channel, which is kind of cool. I'm really pleased to be working with them. Karen and I worked together for over 20 years on a lot of different projects, and she really, you know, was a labor of love for both of us, and I think it was a great job at the end.
Karen, are you sort of like, you know, touching yourself and like saying, oh my God, I got this, you know, got a super author I've worked with for years, but this is the first time he's written something for the family that is being adapted for a television network?
Well, yeah, we were really excited to be doing this as a Hallmark Hall of Fame, because when it was originally written, it was something that, even though we love doing features, this was something that we thought would be perfect for Hallmark. And we kept saying, you know, we should really go to Hallmark, we should really go to Hallmark. And we met a great team of executives there that thought the same thing when they read it and supported us and gave us a great opportunity to do it with a tremendous cast. With Dermot Mulroney and Kimberly Williams Paisley and Danny Glover and Joan Cusack. They put, you know, their team behind it, and we had a great, we actually shot in Vancouver and had a great team there, and I think that we all really wanted to keep to the vision, David's vision of the novel. Tippi and Neil Dabrowski, who wrote the screenplay, it was our goal to make sure that we were true to the novel, and hopefully his fans and Hallmark fans will come together on Saturday and think the same thing.
Mm-hmm. What makes the film magical? What makes, in your mind, what makes this film, apart from the fact that we have a best-selling author behind it, What makes this film stand out? Because with so many Christmas movies, so many holiday films all over the place, it really has to be something to be a Hallmark Hall of Fame presentation. So in your mind, what about it makes it stand out?
Well, what's so special about, you know, the 66-year tradition of the Hallmark Hall of Fame is that a family can come together and watch it, and I was sort of always joking on set that there's Hallmark happy, that you just know that you're in a safe place, it's uplifting, it's positive, that you can go there and be a part of a family. And what David created in The Christmas Train was this safe place where everyone is on this journey from D.C. to Los Angeles, and there's a constant running joke that everything comes out on the train, it always does, that you have this sense of family, that you know what your brothers did and where the bodies are buried when you were a kid, and you know what's going to happen on the train, that what's going to go on, and people thrive on that. And Hallmark, when you is this place where people go, they sit down with their families, they grab the popcorn, they've had their dinner, they put their feet up, and they turn it on, and they know they're going to be there movie after movie. But the Hallmark Hall of Fame, there's just a light, there's a specialness that this film that David, you know, the template of the novel that was true to it in the film was we have family, we have romance, we have mystery, we have a movie director pulling, you know, puppeteering. There's all sorts of fun things that happen. We have an avalanche. There's just so much that happens. And at the end of it all, you feel great, and hopefully everyone will want to go take a train for Christmas and kick back with their families.
David, it sounds like, I'm sure this is an easy something to relate to, it sounds like an adult Polar Express.
It sounds like what?
An adult Polar Express.
One thing I like about how the setup on this was that, you know, the world is so high tech now. Everybody kind of walks through the world oblivious, staring at their smartphones or tied to the internet. And when you get on a train, it's almost like you're stepping back in time a little bit, and it allows you the time to be human. You can jump on a plane and go from D.C. to L.A. in five and a half hours, and it's just a trip. It's not a journey. You're not going to talk to anybody. I joke about that when you get on a plane, the person next to you looks at you like, if you touch my armrest, you know, you're going to be dead. If you talk to me, you're going to be dead. But on a train, you get on, it's almost like you're stepping back in time a little bit, and you're actually allowed to be human again. So you walk through the train cars, you meet people you've never met before and may never meet again. Life slows down a little bit. You actually get to enjoy, you actually get to observe and see what's going on around you and actually listen to other people and learn something about people that you may never meet again in your life. But that's really what brings us together as human beings. I mean, you just slow down and take a breath. Throw the phone, you know, out the window and sit down and actually talk to people and listen and see what's going on around you. And when I watched the film for the first time, that's what I really got. I love the old films where people get on the train as kind of a captive audience, and you're human beings. You have to interact with each other in lots of different ways, and that's what you see on The Christmas Train in just a great number of different ways, many of them delightful and poignant and funny, and it's got the whole package.
You are hearing live popular best-selling author David Baldacci. His best-selling novel, The Christmas Train, is the inspiration for the latest presentation of the Hallmark Hall of Fame, and it comes your way this Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on the Hallmark Channel. David joins us live from Fairfax, Virginia, outside Washington, D.C. We also have executive producer Karen Spiegel. She's joining us live from the Palm Beach area of Florida, and they're both with us this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised, our special pre-free Thanksgiving Day edition. We're glad you're with us both on Blog Talk Radio and on the Hard Radio Podcast Network. You have a question or comment for our guest? Give us a ring, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. You'll find it on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Our good friend Rick Webb from Philadelphia is already in the room. And next Monday on Tomorrow Be Televised, among our guests, we'll have the executive producer of the brand new Oprah Winfrey Network series, Check In. It's an in unlike any other you usually would find. And we'll have the executive producer, Dave Kaplan. That's coming up next Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Be Televised to kick off your week after Thanksgiving. David, talk more about the story and how it blends into what the movie does.
Yeah, this is really if you boil it down to its essentials, this is a journey and second chance for somebody. Tom Langdon his life is not going well. He lost the love of his life. He doesn't know where he is professionally. He's at a crossroads. He's going to take the train to California to meet up with a woman who he's been seeing, but really doesn't think there's a long-term relationship there. And I said it during Christmas because Christmas is supposed to be a time of redemption, a type of second chances. The brand new year is just around the corner, so maybe you get a fresh start, a blank slate. So this is Tom Langdon's second chance at life and maybe happiness. So when he gets on the train in Washington, D.C., he has no idea what's going to happen by the time he gets off the train in Los Angeles, and a lot does happen to him. I'm a thriller writer, so even though this is not a big thriller or mystery or anything like that, I wanted to make it suspenseful in a way, in a good way, that people didn't know what was going to come, you know, around the corner, who was going to open the door, who was going to step out, who was going to meet whom, what was going to happen. So they really were faithful to that plot in the book, and also the main theme about a second chance at life and happiness.
Mm-hmm. Karen, it shows that pace is a very important part of the story because you have all these characters. They're all going toward the same destination, and then you have all of these circumstances and situations that either the whole group of characters gets into, or, for example, DeMont Rose's character as the journalist, Tom Langdon, gets in, that you sort of wonder, is it like Murder on the Orient Express? How many clues do you give before the payoff?
Well, pace obviously is always a concern when you're making a movie because you want to keep the attention of the audience. And I think, you know, David as an author does that well, as, you know, writing page turner after page turner. So we ourselves were looking at that with the film, and, you know, obviously there's commercial breaks. So you have you build up a pace, and you actually, Dave, what you and David just said regarding second chances and Tom and Eleanor, that each character as they come together on the journey, we track them and track their journey with the train. So we start in D.C., and then we go through Ohio, and we go through Illinois, and then we go through Colorado to Los Angeles. And as we're going, we're tracking our way to Christmas, because obviously it's the Christmas train. And so we focus on 4 days to Christmas, 3 days, 2 days, Christmas Eve, where we have our wedding, and then we have Christmas, and then we culminate the story. And so what's great is that we have an inherent ticking clock of getting home for Christmas. And so all the characters, their storylines, because there's a number of second chances throughout the, you know, we have, you know, many, many roles in this movie, but, you know, a core group of people who are focused on the train and have a part in the what's happening to Tom and Eleanor. And so everything sort of culminates ultimately when we get to Los Angeles, but we are able to keep the pace up and things that happen along the way because there are sort of markers across our journey. Just like you do when you take a train and you have a chance to stretch your legs to get off, we do that for the audience.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, with DeMont Rovoni's character, the lead character, he's not only the main protagonist, he's also sort of the chronicler, if you will, because of his background, of the adventures of not only what he's undergoing, but everybody else. So I'm curious how you sort of filter in the sort of first person, third person. We get, you know, the character as the journalist and the character as the person in the middle of the action.
Well, not to give too much away, because yes, Tom is our central character with Eleanor, and he's our, you know, as the journalist, he is, you know, keeping a journal, so to speak, and they're also, you know, researching to write a screenplay along the journey. He himself is also a character within the journey. There's twists and turns that happen because this is based on a Baldacci novel. So there are things that happen within it that keep people peeled to looking for clues of things that happen along the way. So you may be surprised at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm. David,
and hopefully you are.
Yeah, I hope so too. I'm sure that I have a hunch that a lot of listeners, and I know that these Hallmark Channel movies get millions. We're talking anywhere from like 4 to 6 million a pop, and they're getting more popular by the year. So you never know how big that audience is going to be.
Our fingers are crossed for that.
For sure. David, you have a couple that is putting this together, Tippi and Neil Dubrovsky. Are they a husband and wife couple, or how are they related, and how were they found to adapt your story?
For the two lead characters, you mean?
No, for our screenwriters, Tippi and Neil are husband and wife.
Yes, they are.
And they've done a number of movies for Hallmark. Hallmark happens to really rely on them and think that, and they've done a great job, and they know Hallmark's voice very well. And we were, you know, David and I were spoken to by Hallmark on a couple of names that they were interested in. They really wanted Tippi and Neil to do this adaptation, and they're big fans of David's. So it fell together quite beautifully and well, and they did a wonderful job adapting the screenplay.
They really did. I mean, working with and I, we got a chance to look at all the changes in the script, and I was able to look at the input, obviously, as well as Karen. But they really were very faithful to the novel, and they were very receptive to comments that I made, which is very nice. I mean, the best you can do as a novelist who's working, you know, to see one of his books adapted is to get people to share the vision who are professional. I know that movies and books are very different, but you do want sort of, you know, the core of the story to remain in, and they certainly did that, and I thought that they adapted the book beautifully and were very faithful to the themes in it.
And in combination with Tippi and Neil, you know, our grand conductor of the train, Mr. Ron Oliver, who was our director, was able to take, you know, the template from David's novel, you know, knowing David's novel and having read that, and then Neil and Tippi's script, and working with the actors, he created an incredible landscape. Ron is also someone who does a number of movies for Hallmark, both as a screenwriter and a director, and he was able to really masterfully bring The Christmas Train as a Hallmark Hall of Fame to life. And I feel very fortunate that David and I were able to work with him, and he was our, you know, champion of the project.
Yeah. And David, because Ron is a writer as well as director, does that sort of impact the way you have a relationship with him?
Oh, absolutely. I think it does. I mean, I love it when the director is also a writer and knows what the material is like and what the story theme should be, and has even adapted other novels to film. It makes it a lot easier for me. We speak the same language, and I thought we were right in tune from the very first day. And he's done a lot of these and did a terrific job. The cast and crew were great, and they did it remarkably efficiently. I've been on some sets that weren't nearly as efficient as Hallmark was on this film. And, you know, the serendipity of the story too. The wedding is a big deal. It's a big moment on the train. And while I was writing the book, I was on tour for another novel, and I like to, you know, when I'm out on tour, I like to keep in shape. So I go to the gym. I was working out at the gym one night, I think in Nashville, Tennessee, and in the door walks the bride and groom in full regalia. They'd just obviously just been married, and there was somebody from the hotel showing them, I guess, the amenities in the gym. And my first thought was, if you guys are on your honeymoon and you're checking out the gym, I don't know how long this marriage is going to last, but... But that's when I thought, you know what, that's the moment. I'm going to have a wedding on the train. So when people ask me, where do you get your ideas from, I say, truthfully, I get up and I walk out the door, because you never know when something might hit you.
Karen, one of the hallmarks of Hallmark Hall of Fame, so to speak, is always strong cast. No matter what the storyline is, no matter what the adventure is, or the theme of the film is, or the special is, there's always that strong cast. And no question, this one's got as strong as any, because you have Delmar Mooney, wonderful actor. You have Joan Cusack, terrific actress. You have Kimberly Williams-Pierce, and you have Danny Glover. And one more can you say about what that man does and the range of his talent. How did you get them all together?
Well, we had tremendous support from Bill Abbott and the team at Hallmark. They were the advocates to really push and shoot for the absolute best that we can, you know, get for our film, and that was great. They didn't just say, oh, we need to shoot it on this day, so we're just going to grab a cast. They moved mountains to make sure that we had a tremendous cast for Tom, Eleanor, Agnes, and Max. And Hallmark had a vision for it and supported it, and their casting. In Los Angeles, casting was tremendous, and so it came from the top. It was Bill Abbott and Michelle Vickery and Randy Pope. They were all the executives at Hallmark were supportive of, really wanting to help Ron and the team, you know, put together a great film.
Yeah, when I first heard of the cast, when the cast names came through, I think I called Karen and I said, are they doing a feature?
Yeah.
Because the cast was so strong. I mean, it really was remarkable, and the performances were, you know, of a very, very high caliber, and I think we were all thrilled.
Mm-hmm. That's David Baldacci, the author of the best-selling novel, The Christmas Train, which is becoming a Hallmark Hall of Fame feature presentation on the Hallmark Channel this Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. And we also have Karen Spiegel, the executive producer of the film, who has worked with Baldacci on a number of projects beforehand. They're both with us live from Fairfax, Virginia, and Palm Beach, Florida, respectively, this half hour on Tamabi Televised. Got a few more minutes with them, and a few minutes for you to be involved in their conversation. So give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. David, in this era of what some call peak TV, I call it the era of plentiful TV and scripted and unscripted TV, we have seen more authors than ever before, like yourself, get into television various ways. Earlier this year, we had Philip Meyer from The Sun. He became the executive producer, one of the key writers of that AMC show. He's come back for a second season. You're involved with this. You did a TV series beforehand. What do you think about this environment? And what do you think about the fact that we're seeing more authors, both authors of novels and author of plays, get into television, where they're not just creating a concept, they're really digging deep and being part of the program in a big manner?
I think in many ways it's like the golden age for television and novelists. TV is where so much of the cutting-edge work is taking place. You know, the feature films certainly are still out there, and we strive to get some of the books adapted for feature film, but, you know, that space is getting harder and harder to compete with, and it seems like so many movies are, you know, you have to wear a costume, you know, as a superhero in order to have a feature film done. But television, I think, is where so much of the interesting work is being done, and if you have a standalone book, you can find a home for it on one of the television platforms. If you have a series, of which I have many, that translates and dovetails nicely into network television or cable television, but if you have streaming services now, they're doing really fascinating work. And a lot of people, you know, the television audience has become very fragmented. So it's not like 1976 when everybody sits down at 8 o'clock to watch The Waltons. All of America is watching the same show. Television is very fragmented, but at the same time, you have a lot of, you know, rabid fans. And once they find a show and fall in love with it, they stick with it. And for me, as a writer, that really moves me. You know, I love to have that connection with both readers and viewers. And I think, you know, we'll continue to work, Karen and I will continue to work to have as many of the works as we can adapted for television across a variety of platforms, because I think that's where a lot of the interesting work, the really cool work, is happening right now.
Yeah. Do you think you reached the point where you'll create an idea just for the medium itself, without having come from another source?
Yeah, I think so. I'm actually working on a project like that right now that's not based on one of my novels. It was a concept that I created for a television series that they're working on right now. It was interesting. I hadn't done that before. It was a challenge for me to put that together, not based on one of my books, but I found it fascinating and rewarding, and hopefully that will, you know, make it to television at some point. But definitely a lot of opportunities out there, far more, I think, than were out there even 5 years ago. So, again, I think it's kind of a golden age for that. It's a nice mix.
Mm-hmm. Karen, a number of the Hallmark Channel made-for-movies have become franchises where they've come back with sequels, or in the case of Hallmark Movie Mysteries, they've become part of a mystery wheel where you get like four or five of them with a character every year.
Yep.
One could see The Christmas Train becoming maybe an annual occurrence as a Christmas thing, or perhaps just the idea of the train going from one place to another. Maybe the idea for being done in the springtime, or being done for 4th of July, or being done for another holiday.
You are absolutely correct. It was a running conversation on set saying, where are we going next year? I mean, besides the fact that this group, the cast that we put together, it was a tremendous love fest. I mean, once you can even see in the commercials when people are watching, or when they're doing, and Dermot and Kim are doing a lot of interviews together right now, the cast got along so brilliantly and so well, and everyone really enjoyed it. And, you know, it was a great experience. And so I would constantly, you know, shoot texts to David saying, okay, we have the wedding train. We have the, like, what's this train going to be next year? The train to, you know, a different city, or are we going to a different country on a honeymoon and we're going to do something and everyone's going to be reassembled? Or is it going to be, you know, are we going to get Tom and Eleanor together on a wedding? And, you know, they do a good job. You know, they just had All of My Heart, and then they just did a sequel to that at Hallmark. They do a lot of that, and it's very successful. If hopefully, fingers crossed, that we do well this Saturday, which I'm hoping everyone gets out there and watches it and tunes in this Saturday, the 25th, for the Christmas train, that we will, you never know where the train will take us. And I'm sure David will be hanging up the phone later and going, where's that train going to go next?
That's right, yeah. I'm on board.
He's on board. Yeah. Oh, see, that's train speak. That's train speak for you, Simon. Train speak. I'm all on board.
You got
we had a lot of train speak on set.
I can see it now, David. A new book, The Classic Guide to Trains, Train Speak for Dummies.
Right, exactly.
You know,
we had a lot
I'm
of
open,
train speak.
I'm open for a lot, yeah.
Yes.
And by the way, dummies are not dummies. I want to be very clear to our audience. You folks out there listening, you're not dummies. We're just like being a little facetious here. But David, one more thing before we go. What's it like to have in your cap now association with one of the most prestigious ventures in television history? Something that's lasted 60, 70 years, the Hallmark Hall of Fame, which has had a lot of iterations over the years, but still, you know, has that feel of you watch this program. No matter what it's about, you're watching quality, quality cast, quality work, and now that's part of your legacy.
Yeah, it's something I'll always have. You know, it's quite a you know, I've had a long career. This is kind of a nice little cap to it as well, because I've been a fan of the Hallmark Channel for a long time, as were my kids growing up. Lots of people that I know watch Hallmark. I do too. In this day and age, you know, when things are so unpredictable and life gets a little stressful, it's a great place to sort of park yourself to, you know, feel good about things and have some hope. So it's great. You know, I love that it came about at this point in my career too, because I've been doing this a long time, but this is something that's really special. And the association with Hallmark is something that I'll always have and can always share with people. And it's they're a great organization. And, you know, not only do they make great films, but they're great people. And that's not always the case, you know, and in doing this line of work. And for me, it was the whole package. And, again, to get to work with Karen, again, who's terrific at her job, and I can't say enough about how she does her job on the set. She's the ultimate professional, and she's kind and generous with everyone. But the kind of cast we have in the back, and we have from Hallmark, and the script, it was like the perfect storm in a great way. You know, when I first watched the film, I was a little, you know, you never know, am I going to like this or not? And after I watched it for the fifth time and loved it, you know, just as much as I loved it when I watched it the first time, then it's a great feeling. And to know that we're in partnership with Hallmark on this, you know, that's kind of like the icing on the cake.
And to speak to that, I just want to...
I'm sorry, go ahead, Karen.
I was going to say, to speak to that, you know, having worked with David for a long time, and when we were on set, we're all very anxious until we have that first check off, like checking off the checklist that David signs off, that you want to know, did he see dailies? Oh, my goodness, is everything okay? And then when he saw the cut, how did he like it? And to know that David, as the author, as the originator of the piece, and then liked it and then loved it, and I, you know, my spies in the office said, oh, he laughed at the right places and cried at the right places, and then to hear the screenwriters seeing it after they've written it and we turn it in, and then to have the executives like it, you know, we just want so badly as filmmakers to make sure that when it gets to the audience that it's gone through all the checklists and that that everyone will be happy, because it is Hallmark happy, as I started the conversation, that we want, you know, we've done our job right if everyone stays tuned in the whole time and stays live and watches it when it airs and enjoys it. And so hopefully we've all done that job. So,
from its beginnings in the early 1950s, the motto of the Hallmark Hall of Fame has been, when you care enough to send the very best. And that is again the case with Hallmark Hall of Fame's latest presentation, the adaptation of David Baldacci's best-selling novel, The Christmas Train. Demont Maroney, Kimberly Williams Paisley, Danny Glover, Joan Cusack, all in the cast, directed by Ron Oliver, adaptation by Tippi and Neil Dubrovsky. And it all begins this Saturday night on the Hallmark Channel, 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific Time. Check your list of the Hallmark Channel is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about the program online, www.hallmarkchannel.com. David Baldacci and Karen Spiegel, thank you both very much for joining us. I wish both of you and your families a wonderful holiday season. David, we hope that, love to have you both of you back. And David, I hope that this continues with more great work in television.
Great. Thank you very much. Happy holidays.
Thank you so much for having us. Happy holidays. Thank you.
You're welcome, David and Karen. Take care. All the greatest.
Thank you.
David Baldacci and Karen Spiegel, author, executive producer of The Christmas Train on Hallmark Channel and Hallmark Hall of Fame, joining us live from Fairfax, Virginia and Palm Beach area, Florida. This is Tomorrow Channel Live with a phone call about television, coming your way on Blog Talk Radio and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Remember, if you came in late on today's program, you want to catch up an episode you missed, go to our homepage. It's blogtalkradio.com/televised. blogtalkradio.com/televised. Or go on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network at www.iHeartRadio.com. When you get there, put Tomorrow We Televise in the search box. Click the box. You'll get our show, this episode, and other episodes as well. You can also find a chat room where you can comment on the program. Love to hear from you. So go to iHeartRadio.com. I think you will enjoy. You can also catch the podcast version of the show on iTunes.com and Apple TV's iTunes podcast app. If you don't have Apple TV, go to an Apple store near you or order it online. It makes a great holiday to give. When we come back, the composer of Hulu's new hit series from Seth Rogen, Future Man, which premiered last week, is Emmy nominee Hallie Coultry. And we'll have the latest on our Classic Trivia Question of the Week. Would you believe we may have a winner? But not yet. I'll explain. All that after we pause at the top of the next hour for web identification. You are connected to the best internet radio on the planet. It's www.blogtalkradio.com. Well, there's 25 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Check out WSI tomorrow, 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific, only on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, you can catch the best of BTR 24/7 at YouTube.com. And our show and other BTR programs also around the clock at the Apple TV iTunes podcast app. Welcome back to Tomorrow We Televise. Well, you'll be just joining us at the top of the evening hour on the East Coast, mid-afternoon hour on the West, and everything else in between. Simon Appleby live from New York, second of three shows we're doing this Thanksgiving week, 2017. Happy you are aboard. And we have another great guest coming your way in the half hour ahead. So stick around, tell your friends to tune in, and be part of the conversation. All you need to do is pick up the phone and dial 646-652-2906. 646-652-2906. The numbers give anywhere you're catching us across the country or around the world here on Blog Talk Radio. Chat room open too. Find it on our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia, is still in the room. Over the years on this program, we've had wonderful contributions from some of the top TV composers around. People like Nathan Barr of The Americans, Matt Quayle won the Emmy Award last year for Mr. Robot on USA Network, and many, many more. And we have another to add to the list. This person you're about to hear is an Emmy nominee, and his latest work is the brand-new Hulu series that premiered last week, Future Man. Joining us live from Los Angeles, Emmy nominee, Hallie Coultry. Hallie, happy holiday season to you, and welcome in.
Thanks, Simon. How's it going?
Very, very well, thank you. Tell us about how you got involved with Future Man.
Oh, well, let's see. I met Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, his producing partner, through my friendship and recent collaborations with the composer Henry Jackman. Henry's someone that I've known for about 5-6 years now, and I've written music on some of his latest his projects, his latest film scores. And he's known Seth and Evan for a good few years because he scored some of their recent movies like The Interview and This Is the End, things like that. And so I got to meet them through Henry, and was lucky enough to get the chance to score the pilot episode for Future Man last year. And so I did that, and on the strength of that, I was invited to do the series this year.
Mm-hmm. Future Man is a time-traveling drama, so when time travel comes to mind, what immediately comes to mind for you in terms of, okay, this is the musical style I'm going to deploy here?
Oh, well, I did sort of toy with the idea of, because it's a show that's kind of a very affectionate homage to and tribute to 80s sci-fi movies. I thought, well, I wonder whether the score ought to sort of, you know, tip its hat in that direction as well from time to time. But the trouble is, you don't want to end up with just a pastiche score. I mean, I've got some occasional nods and winks here and there, but you know, you've got to come up with a sort of signature sound for the show that is its own unique sound. And so, I guess my starting point would have been the main theme for Josh, the main character, who is who in this, if you haven't seen the show yet, is obsessed with this video game, Biotic Wars, which he spends many hours of his life playing. And so I thought, well, the music ought to, or at least his theme, ought to sound a bit like something that would you'd plausibly expect to hear in a video game like that. And since the game is set in a kind of, you know, futuristic dystopia, rather sort of Terminator-esque, in which humanity has been all but wiped out by a race of super beings called biotics. I thought that meant that this sort of soundscape of the show ought to be very futuristic, but also kind of slightly sort of rugged and muscular, and you know, and the game that he plays is a first-person shooter, so there's a lot of, you know, gunfire and violence and so on. And so I kind of thought that the theme ought to have that character. And then, in more widely speaking, the general sound of the show, I thought, ought to be sort of futuristic and electronic and quite sort of synth-driven. So yeah, those were the basic thought processes.
We seem to have quite a few obsessive characters roaming around various areas of television these days. One of my favorite shows right now is Mr. Robot on USA. I think it's an extraordinary show, and it's in the third season. And everyone involved continues from Sam Esmail, the writer-director, to Matt Quayle, the musician, to Todd Campbell, director of photography, just keep pushing the envelope. 2 weeks ago, the incredible, what I call the one-take, one-camera episode, which looks like it was shot from start to finish, an hour in one camera, one take, no editing, and USA ran the show, the episode commercial free. And I'm thinking,
oh,
what hit me...
Check it out.
Yeah, do so. And one of the things that Sam Esmail does is he does long takes. He loved the idea of taking a camera for like 8-9 minutes at a time, or up to that time, and doing a whole scene and have the music stay with it from that time. And I'm wondering, have you found that with Future Man 2, where, let's say, the producers will want you to write for a particular scene and really stretch the music, build it up, so it runs, let's say, 5, 6, 7 minutes at a time?
Oh, yes, that did happen, yes. And particularly, I would say, towards the end, certainly in the final episode, it's virtually wall-to-wall music. Because that's sort of the culmination of the entire show. There was lots of scope for music to build slowly and over time, you know. And I do find that when I'm writing, I always tend to gravitate towards, you know, the first thing that I do is look out for those spots, you know, where is the most substantial section where most music is called for, and start there. That's usually where I like to start, because that allows you to really kind of be most sort of expansive musically and develop themes most completely. So that tends to be my approach, because then you've got a sort of those longer stretches of music function as kind of the foundations for the rest of it, and so you'll find, as I say, particularly in the final episode, there's lots of stretches like that where there are lots of, sort of intercut scenes, and the music needed to sort of glue them all together, as it were. There are a few other moments like that in I can recall in episode 2 as well. There's a scene which keeps cutting back and forth between various things that are going on at the same time, and the music had to sort of overarchingly go through all of it.
Emmy nominee Hallie Cawthery is our guest this half hour on Toronto Televised. He is the music composer behind Future Man, the brand new critically acclaimed series on Hulu, which is all about a time traveling gamer and the adventures that person encounters. Played by John Hutchinson of Hunger Games fame. Hallie joins us live in Los Angeles this half hour on Toronto Televised. Thanksgiving week edition number 2 for this week. Simon Applebaum with you live from New York. Happy you're with us. whether you're joining us on a Tuesday night on the East Coast or coming late Tuesday afternoon on the West and everything in between. If you have a question or comment for Hallie, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use the chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Coming up tomorrow, another 90-minute episode before you get off to your holiday weekend. Coming up at a regular hour, 3:30 Eastern Pacific, we'll have popular radio and podcast host George Benninger. He'll be joining us here in New York. We'll get his thoughts about where TV is at, where it's going, and maybe some Thanksgiving tidbits about what's the best to watch and maybe what to avoid, too. Then, from the brand-new Freeform movie, Angry Angel, starring Brenda Song, executive producer Richard Schwartz. And finally, a wonderful pre-Thanksgiving treat, the two other co-stars of the brand-new Amazon Studios series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, premiering next Wednesday on Smart TV sets and Smart DV devices. Michael Dean and Maren Hinkle. One plays the heroine's husband, the other, the heroine's mother. The Mrs. Maisel thing, what we're talking about. And a lot of people are very high about this series, written by Amy Sherman-Palladino and Daniel Palladino of Gilmore Girls fame. It's all coming up tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, right here, exclusively on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. When you get an assignment like Future Man, Hallie, what works best for you? Do you basically want to be left off to your own to figure out how to compose, or do you want Seth or somebody else to give you some direction about where to go?
It's a good question. It varies from project to project, but I suppose the basic process is the same. You want to go away and ideally, you know, you start by having a conversation with the filmmakers or the series makers or whoever it is, and you know, get their thoughts on what sort of how they envisage the what they imagine the music might sound like and what sort of soundscape it might occupy. And then I tend to like to start by writing away from picture. You know, as soon as I come on a project, I get a sort of rough cut of the picture in its latest, in its most current form. But I always like to start by writing away from it because I think probably most composers would tell you this. You need to sort of have a strong idea in place before you start scoring scenes, because the danger is that if you immediately sort of dive in and start scoring scenes, the danger is that you end up just scoring from moment to moment and without really a sense of the whole. So for example, in this case, the main theme that I talked about earlier, Josh's theme, was the thing that I worked on first. And that was written just sort of in itself, away from picture. And once I had it, and once I'd written the theme, and not only that, but sort of decided what sort of wider soundscape it should exist in, I then sort of tried it out in various different forms, because, you know, it's all very well to have an idea that works for a particular kind of emotional context, but it also needs to be sort of adaptable enough to also work in a different emotional context several episodes down the line. You know, you might want to, supposing your character is going through has a more emotional scene. Does this idea work as a more emotional idea as opposed to a heroic idea? So I tend to like to just do a bit of fiddling around and trying to see how many different ways I can get my idea to work. Once I've got that in place, then do I start scoring scenes. And then it's just a case of, you know, once you've spent a couple of weeks kicking ideas around and experimenting, then, you know, you want to sort of play what you've got to the filmmakers or the showrunners or whatever, and get their approval for what you're doing and make sure that you're on the right track and so on. And then it's a give and take sort of collaborative process from there on in.
Mm-hmm. One of the first TV composers to make it very big, he was a film composer first before he knew television, was a man in the 1950s named Herschel Brook Gilbert. And he was one of the founding fathers of TV scoring. He did a show called The Rifleman, starring Chuck Connors, as a widow or with a father living in Norfolk. And the music he wrote for that, starting with the opening theme, was so striking and so well placed that it really had an impact on the popularity of the program. At one point, Gilbert joked that at one point the music got more mail than the star because it was so so enjoyable to hear and so distinct and so memorable. I know it's only been a week old, or just about a week since Hulu started Future Man. But are you starting to get fan mail from people who enjoy your music? And what do you think about, let's say, in a Scorsese film, you know, getting fan mail? Do you like that? Or you prefer that? You know, just let's be your own druthers and compose what you want.
Well, I can't say I've received any fan mail yet for Future Man, but you know, I remain open to receiving it. Yeah, I mean, occasionally you sort of get people sort of hitting you up on social media and saying, "And hey, I really liked your music on this. You know, is it available anywhere?" That sort of thing. So that does happen. Not terribly often, but enough to be, you know, pleasing.
When you do an episode of a show like Future Man, do you like to stay in one soundscape, as you call it, or do you like to mix it up? The last episode, go back to Mr. Robot for a second. The episode was on this past week. Matt Quayle's score for that episode starts with like a nursery rhyme kind of theme because it has kids involved in the scene. But then later on, in one of the, again, those long takes, you have this like slow building, like underneath everything, where our hero, played by Robbie Malek, has to save the day from what could be a building explosion. From various villains, and the scene builds up and builds up and builds up and builds up and builds up, so that by the time things, you know, when you think it's going to happen, the music is like on, you know, you're on pins and needles because of the score. I'm curious, you know, how you see what you do episode to episode, whether you like one style throughout or mix it up.
Well, it entirely depends on the project, really. I mean, something like this, there was a sort of basic soundscape to the show that I felt was sort of the show's sound, which is the very sort of electronic synth kind of sound. And interestingly, there were one or two occasions where I sort of strayed a little too far orchestral, and the showrunners actually pulled me up on it and said, no, this is getting a bit too far away from what the core sound of the show is. So that was the sort of, you need to sort of have that as your sort of foundation. But within that, you know, because this is a show that keeps jumping around from time frame to time frame, the music does definitely change. There is, for example, an episode that in which one of the characters time travels back to the, I think it's the 50s, I want to say, and so the music in that one, there was scope for it to get a bit more kind of a little less futuristic in sound and more orchestral and more lush. And then there's an episode which is constructed like a kind of old-fashioned sex farce, you know, with lots of people in the same house running from room to room and trying not to be seen, and that required a much more comedic approach, and so the score in that episode is very sort of quirky and orchestral. So it really, it depends on where the story takes you. Really, you need to, for a show like this, as I say, there is a sound which is the sort of basic sound of the show, but within that, it does sort of break out of its parameters from time to time.
Future Man is the new series on Hulu. It's been around for about a week, available on smart TV sets and smart TV devices all over the place. And we've got the composer of the series, Hallie Kukri. He joins us live from Los Angeles in half hour here on Tomorrow Be Televised. So a few more minutes with him before we wrap things up for this Tuesday night of Thanksgiving week. So get a call in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. And coming up, we'll give you the latest info on our classic trivia question of the week. We think we have a winner. I'll tell you why I think we think that in a few minutes. How did the door open for you to become a TV composer?
Good question. Well, it, I started out about 10 years ago or so in film. Before that, I was working in London. I grew up in the UK, as you can probably tell. I was living and working in London as a musician. I was a classical violinist by training, and I was so I was doing a lot of teaching and playing on the London orchestral scene and writing music for the concert hall. And I reached a point where I was sort of evaluating, you know, the state of my life and career and so on, as one does in one's mid-20s. I suppose there is a sort of parallel universe in which I simply continue to do that. And, you know, I could very well still be living and working in London as a freelance jobbing musician. But I sort of began to think, you know, if I want to earn a living writing music, I really ought to think about trying to get into film and TV. And I sort of just began to think who I might know to contact. And as it happened, when I was a kid, I used to go to these sort of like summer music camps when I was sort of between the ages of 8 and 11 in my hometown. And on the staff of these music camps was a young man in his early, mid-20s called Harry Gregson-Williams, which is a name some of your listeners might know. He's a very fine film composer. And in the intervening years,
he composed the Shrek movies. He's the composer for the Shrek films.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, yes. And he was he's done music to The Martian, and he was a long-time collaborator with Tony Scott before Tony's tragic death. And so I knew Harry when I was sort of 9 or 10 years old, and then lost touch with him. And about 10, 12 years later, I happened to find myself seated in front of a TV watching, it was Ants. I don't know if you remember that movie. One of the early DreamWorks animations. It's the one, set in an ant colony with Woody Allen as the lead voice character.
I loved it.
And I was watching this.
A lot of fun. Very funny movie.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I was always a huge Woody Allen fan, so I was really intrigued to hear him do a voiceover part. And I really remember really liking the music and sort of keeping an eye out for who wrote it. And Harry's name came up. He co-wrote the score with John Powell. And I sort of bolted up right in my seat and said, you know, good Lord, that's Harry Gregson-Williams. I used to know him. And so then a couple of years later when I was thinking, well, who do I know that I could write to for advice? His name immediately came to mind. And it so happened that this would be 2004, I suppose. He was in London doing a movie called Kingdom of Heaven with Ridley Scott. And so he said, and for some contractual reason, he had to write the score in London. So he had decamped. He was already living and working in LA at the time. So he'd moved his studio over to do that score, and he said, why don't you come over and we'll have a catch-up and a chat. And to cut a long story short, I got back in touch with Harry and ended up coming over to LA and working under him, and he was really my sort of mentor in the film music business.
You know, it's fascinating that so many great film and TV composers, whether it's people like Eric Korngold or John Williams, who's still out there today, both in film and television,
yeah.
Or one of my favorites, Jerome Morose, wrote the great score for The Big Country, one of the most underrated composers around, Hugo Friedhofer, and some of our composers today, they still write for the concert hall, and they do some really wonderful things. That, in fact, we had on our show earlier this year, Lourdes Manas, the cartoon the Emmy Award-winning animation composer who just had a concert a few weeks ago of one of her latest pieces here in New York, and she was terrific.
Oh, is that right?
Absolutely terrific. Score about the immigrant. It was part of a concert about the immigrant experience, and just really, really sensational. Future Man.
Fantastic, yeah.
Yep, absolutely. Future Man, it is on Hulu, and if you have a smart TV set, a smart TV device, chances are you can catch it anytime you like, 24/7. So check it out, Future Man, with Seth Rogen, one of the creators, and Halle's work, as the composing with the music score from episode to episode. For more details about the program and about the network or the service, go to Hulu.com, www.hulu.com. Future Man available 24/7, smart TV sets and smart devices. Howie Cawthorne, the composer of Future Man and other great works as well. Thank you for joining us. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving holiday. Let's have you back soon. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Simon, so much. Thank you for having me, and happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
You are very welcome. Take care. All the greatest.
Bye-bye.
Howie Cawthorne of Future Man on Hulu, joining us live from Los Angeles. And now the latest, our classic trivia question of the week before we say good day or good night, depending on where you are. On Monday, we brought you the question, and it was this. Name Denise Crosby's character on Star Trek The Next Generation. We know the full name. Well, this morning, we had an email with that winning answer. However, we are still waiting for that person to give us the full mailing address. Hopefully, by tomorrow's show at 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific, we will have that person and that address, so we can tell you who the person is, and we'll give you the answer. So we will hold off on accepting any other answers for now. If it turns out that that person doesn't want to respond, we'll put the question back in play. So hopefully tomorrow, we'll let you know if we have that winner, and who that winner is, and, of course, the answer. And remember, if you want to play our Classic Trivia Question of the Week, you always email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com, simonapple04@yahoo.com. The prize in play, The Genius, The Last Chapter DVD from Nancy Rabbit, and the books The Showrunner by Cy Chermak, and Walking Distance by Victor Kahn. So tune in tomorrow and hear if we've got a winner and the winning answer to this week's Classic Trivia Question. And also on tomorrow's program, back at our regular time, Pacific, we'll have popular radio and podcast host George Benninger, the executive producer of the new freeform Christmas movie Angry Angel with Brenda Song, Richard Schwartz, and our special co-star guest from the marvelous Mrs. Marzell on Amazon Studios, Michael Zieger and Maren Hinkle. That's all coming up tomorrow, our final Thanksgiving Week episode of the week, 3 p.m. Eastern New Pacific, right here on Tomorrow We Tell Us. Again, I want to thank all of our guests for a wonderful 90 minutes, and all of you for listening in, whether you're doing it on Blog Talk Radio or on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. If you came in late on today's program, or you want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to our homepage anytime you like, blogtalkradio.com/televised. That's blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out the podcast version in several ways, iTunes.com, Apple TV's iTunes Podcast app, and now the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Just put Tomorrow We Televise in the search bar, click it in, you get our show. Also, you can make comments about it anytime you like in our chat room. We always love hearing from you. What's your thoughts about our guest today? And where do you stand on the future of television? Where it's at and where it's going? Just email me. Again, SimonApple04@yahoo.com. SimonApple04@yahoo.com. And don't forget, you can also follow me on Facebook, find me on Twitter. And this is the handle, UBCSimonTWBT. That's at UBCSimonTWBT. We always love hearing from you. Why? Because what you say matters any time of the year. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants, not the three of those of Blog Talk Radio. Our production associate is Candace Williams. Andy Toe is Blog Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Sonberg, executive content producer. The co-founders of this enterprise are Alan Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow We Televise was brought to you today by Audible.com and Amazon Company. Give the gift of reading and listening in one with a trial subscription to Audible.com. To do that, go to audibletrial.com/televised. Remember, Audible will transform the way you hear the world. It's a proud development partner of the 2017 New York Television Festival. But Tomorrow We Televise, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. And join us back here one more day this Thanksgiving week for our pre-Thanksgiving special. Tomorrow, Wednesday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio, and also along the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Whatever you're doing tonight or tomorrow, be safe and be great out there. Until next time, stay well and stay tuned.